of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, indivisible, one nation, under God. Thank you. Very good. Many of us grew up with this pledge from kindergarten to high school. I don't know if they actually do it every day in the morning like we did, but it was a good exercise that would have been even better had more time been spent on explaining why we acknowledge the meaning behind it. Here's one of the stories behind the meaning and the symbolism of the Pledge of Allegiance. This one is very close to my heart because it involves a fellow Marylander. During the War of 1812, in September of 1814, Francis Scott Key was sent to negotiate the release of Dr. William Beans, a civilian who was captured by the British after the burning of Washington, D.C. Key boarded a British ship under a flag of truce and successfully secured the release of Dr. Bean. However, because Key had overheard the British plans to attack Fort McHenry in the Baltimore Harbor, he was detained aboard a ship during the 25-hour bombardment that took place September 13th and 14th, 1814. And from his vantage point, Key watched anxiously through the night. Then at dawn, he saw the American flag still flying over the fort, a sign that the fort had been held. He was moved by that sight, and he penned the poem Defense of Fort McHenry, which was later set to the tune of To Anacreon in Heaven and became the Star-Spangled Banner. Part of the backstory includes maybe some apocryphal information. Perhaps the heroic efforts of some of those within the compound's walls of Fort McHenry who valiantly kept the flag and its pole aloft as some of the British shells hit near the area. There's a powerful legend, nobody knows whether it's totally true or not, that men died to preserve the flag that night and keep it flying, but it's not a part of the official battle record. But at dawn on September 14th, a larger garrison flag was hoisted up the flagpole, and that became the inspiration for Francis Scott Key and his poem. Another story, and there are many of these, and you've probably been taught many of them, another story is the incredible saga of American general and later president who had remarkable courage and organization skills, was very resilient, Andrew Jackson. On January 8th, in 1815, Jackson's forces, which were a combination of ragtag volunteers, some French pirates, and a bunch of different people that had been molded together into a fighting unit, were entrenched behind earthworks made of mud and cotton bales, and they repelled a frontal assault by British troops, elite British troops. In just 37 minutes in the Battle of New Orleans, the British suffered over 2,000 casualties, while Jackson's side lost only 71 men. The lopsided victory stunned the world and made Jackson a national hero. Why was it important? Because the United States, about a decade or so earlier, had secured the purchase of Louisiana, the vast tract of land for a fraction of what it was worth. And the British, if they could defeat the American forces in Louisiana, would have a foothold on overtaking that possession of the United States. Ironically, the Treaty of Ghent had been signed that ended officially the War of 1812 several weeks prior to this battle. But news hadn't reached New Orleans yet, so the battle was technically fought after the peace was declared. But it was a defining moment in American pride and resilience. The American defeat of the British was stunning. This is the same British Navy and Army that had earlier defeated Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo and changed European history. Europe could have become a dictatorship, but the British were able to overwhelm them during that time years earlier. There are so many stories of American valor and American courage and American resilience as this nation has fought to keep alive the vision of freedom and independence, that it's mind-boggling. We did learn many of those things in school, perhaps most of you did. But what drove the men, the signers of the Declaration of Independence and other pioneers in the early days of our country's founding, what drove them to persevere under the most adverse conditions, things that we would frankly mostly crumble under during this time? Why did the signers of the Declaration of Independence write on the last line, "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor"? What drove those men? What inspired those men to take such a stand against the most powerful nation on the face of the earth at the time? On this July 4th weekend, it is fitting that we review, and here is my title, Liberty, Founded in Law, the Biblical Foundation of America, a subject that is so vast, I am awed to be able to speak on it, but I can only touch on the surface. There is so much more to this. And I developed this idea or this sermon based on the fact that there are many people who today feel that the United States ideals and the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution was based mostly on the thoughts of Enlightenment and the great writers of the Enlightenment of the 16th, 17th centuries. And that while some of those individuals also adopted biblical ideas, the idea that our nation was founded on anything other than the Holy Bible is strictly fiction and nonsense. So I thought I would take this opportunity to repel those false ideals and to give example after example after example as to why this country was founded and why it is majestic, it's magnificent, it is divinely inspired, not by Greek ideals of thousands of years ago, but by the Holy Bible inspired by God. So the title is Liberty, Founded in Law, the Biblical Foundation of America. The United States is a nation that is founded on principles that are deeply rooted in biblical morality and divine law. While we're not a theocracy, and never intended to be, the influence of God's word, especially the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, and the Ten Commandments, is undeniable in the formation of our government and society. And while many people have argued that the framers of the Constitution weren't really religious men, nothing could be further from the truth. Every one of them was. I mean, we have lost so much information over the years as to how this nation was predicated, what its foundation was. Do you know that at the time of the Revolution, the Bible was the most widely taught book, not only in churches, but in schools? It was read regularly. It's only been until perhaps the last 100 years that the Bible wasn't usually used in many churches. But in the early days of our founding, from the time of the Puritans up until the time of the Revolutionary War, the Bible was used. Maybe it was used on the wrong day on Sundays, except for the Seventh-day churches that existed during that time. And there were those along with the Church of God during the time, from the time of the 1600s. The Bible was used and read and studied as a point of literature more so than any book in the history of mankind, especially at the time of our founding. It was the greatest circulated book even at that time. And I think, as Mr. Walden mentioned a few Sabbaths ago, or last Sabbath, last time he spoke, the Bible was the first book that was printed by the Gutenberg Press in Germany. So from John Adams, he wrote, my friend Mike's favorite president, John Adams, the second president, he wrote in a letter to Thomas Jefferson in July 28, 1813, he said, "The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God. Does that sound like one of the rational thought leaders of the 17th and 18th centuries? Hardly so. And when you examine, let's turn to Exodus chapter 20, and we'll go through the Ten Commandments, because the Ten Commandments are the foundation of our laws today in the United States. They provide a moral and legal code echoed in Western jurisprudence and U.S. founding ideals. Some would say, well, they're not keeping the Sabbath. Let's not get cynical today. They did the best they could with the information that they had at the time. In Exodus 20 and verse 1, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And as we'll hear a little bit later in the message, they traced and thought that there was an extreme parallel between what happened to ancient Israel and what happened to them during revolutionary times. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image. Now I'm reading just parts of the commandments. Verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Verse 12, honor your father and your mother. Verse 13, you shall not murder. 14, you shall not commit adultery. 15, you shall not steal. 16, you shall not bear false witness. And 17, you shall not covet. And there are parallels to the American ideals that are embodied in our founding documents. Religious freedom is based on the freedom to worship, which is noted in the third commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. The rule of law shows the respect for life and property and truth, verses 13 through 16. And then personal responsibility, honoring your parents and having fidelity towards your spouse. All of these are a matter of personal religious freedom, understanding the rule of law, and personal responsibility of the individual. James Madison wrote, "We have staked the whole future of American civilization not upon the power of government, far from it. We have staked the future upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God." You see, much of what some of us have been taught during the time of school did not include this information, did not include this very valid information, but you can bet that these men knew it. They lived by it. They read it. They were governed by it in their own lives. In the Declaration of Independence, let's take a look at some of the excerpts of that. And of course, we know that Thomas Jefferson, wrote the Declaration of Independence almost solely by himself. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Now, what do the critics of that say today? Well, yeah, but these guys were slave owners. They had slaves themselves. They didn't really believe in that themselves. And the answer to that is that certainly they were imperfect men. But you know that it was first the United Kingdom, the British Isles, that totally abolished slavery, and the United States was second in the history of mankind to abolish slavery. While many other nations of the world still held to the precepts of slavery, and many, many, many other nations, and still today, slavery is bigger now than it was ever at the time of the American Revolution. So we're not making any excuses. I certainly wouldn't make any excuses. But those men were imperfect, but they had perfect ideals expressed. And of course, sometimes we all fall short of the law, correct? In Deuteronomy chapter 10, Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 17, we read, "For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. There are a lot of commandments and laws that are bound up within our Constitution and our the framers' thoughts and ideas about how a society should be governed that are brought out even in that first verse. No partiality, no respecter of persons, and no bribery. He administers justice for the fatherless and the widow. This is encompassed and codified in laws that we have on the books today. And loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Therefore, love the stranger, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. In Genesis chapter 1 and verse 27, the framers read, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." And for the first time in history, laws were formulated and codified by man that protected individual rights because they knew that mankind was made in the image of God. They knew the New Testament as well, and they drew inspiration from passages such as Acts 17 and verse 26, where Paul made his famous speech to the Athenians, which reads, a part of it, which is, "And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and boundaries of their dwellings." The founders of the U.S. Constitution and the framers of the Declaration of Independence felt very, very strongly in the 13 colonies and felt very strongly in the freedoms and the rights of those assembled, and they respected the rights, certainly, of other nations. But it was George Washington who warned against getting entangled with foreign alliances, and that is one of the secular prophecies that still stands the test of time. I dare say that had we as a nation followed that advice, we might be a lot better off today. But the idea that rights come from God and not government was revolutionary, if you'll pardon the pun, and thoroughly biblical in its concept. Now also, as you look at the Constitution and the biblical wisdom in the governance between the three areas of government, federal government, there's the judicial side, there is the legislative slide, and there is the executive. There's a separation of powers. Where did they get that, which had never come about? There's the checks and balances that have been abounding throughout our history. Where did they get that? Would you believe that they understood that separation of powers needed to be made? They got it right from the book of Isaiah. In fact, in Isaiah chapter 33, and verse 22, you see this separation of powers in this statement, Isaiah. It's all relative to God being the one that could coordinate all three aspects of governance. But for the Lord is our judge, the judicial aspect that the framers came up with, that there would be courts and that there would be judges who could be appointed, and then laws were made so that they could be elected as well. A judicial system. The Lord is our lawgiver. There was a legislative branch, the Congress and the Senate, which was determined to write the laws that would govern the land. All of it would be based on the Ten Commandments, as we see. And the Lord is our king, the executive branch of the governance. Even though kingship was rejected, there was a president who has powers that are very similar in many ways, but he's not entitled to just do everything that he wants. So these verses contain all three branches of government, the judicial, legislative, and executive branch. And furthermore, in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verses 18 through 20, Moses was told, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you according to your tribes. And they shall judge the people with just judgment." What would that judgment be based on? It would be based on the Ten Commandments and the rest of the law that God gave to Israel. "You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality. Every individual would have the exact same rights. nor take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you. From the very foundation of the nation of Israel and the 12 tribes, they are given this beautiful law. And of course, mankind can always mess up those things, and his intent can be wrong. In Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 13, one of the passages that I use in my latest blog, that is the responsibility of our government now as it finds out injustice and problems and difficulties that have been going on in our land, that if they don't do something, if they don't prosecute, when they find evil, if they don't administer justice, then the whole thing fails. And of course, Solomon was inspired to write, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. And as Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy 3, not one that I've got in my notes, but I've quoted it often, evil men wax worse, and evil men and imposters wax worse and worse, especially in light of the fact that if their evil works are not stopped, they just have more incentive to do more and more evil. That's what we see happening all around us. Now, you're well aware of the fact that the Bill of Rights has God-given freedoms. It gives us the First Amendment, freedom of religion, speech, of the press, the freedom to assemble. These were ideas that were totally unheard of in the rest of the world. And in many places of the world, even in what we would call the English-speaking nations of the world outside of the U.S., they're not allowed in some cases. In Great Britain, for instance, you're taking a great risk if you demonstrate against Islamic law and if you speak out against Sharia law. In some parts of England today, you could be arrested and put in jail. You cannot even stand outside. They put a woman in prison for standing outside praying silently against abortion. They asked her what she was doing there. She's saying, I'm just praying that God will not allow this to happen. They arrested her, put her in jail. They arrest people for their social media posts if the government doesn't agree with it. So in the United States, we still have many of those freedoms which are guaranteed by law. In other parts of the world, not so much. Galatians 5 and verse 1, Paul said, stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not become entangled again with the yoke of bondage. What he's speaking about is sin. Sin is bondage to us. The liberty which is given to us is when we are obedient to the law, and that's the same kind of liberty that was given to the people that lived in the United States of America from the time of the Revolution. In Psalm chapter 19, beginning in verse 7, we read, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. These freedoms reflect the desire that God had that people be free to worship and live righteously and not be enslaved in tyranny or sin, and have the opportunity to choose how they would worship God and whether they would worship God. It may not be totally perfect. It would not be the way it's done in the world tomorrow. But Patrick Henry said that it cannot be emphasized too strongly or too often that this great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians, not on religions, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. These are remarks that he made to the Virginia Convention prior to the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1775. They drew their inspiration from Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 11. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. That is something that I think we could probably agree that many in our nation have forgotten today, or maybe never knew in the first place. We have been blessed so much. We have reaped the blessings of Abraham so much that it's an expectation, not an understanding, that God has given that to us. It's really kind of sad, but I know it's something that you give thanks for all the time. And I guess as a personal aside, my feeling is that based on the last 60 years of my life and viewing what has gone on, and also my experience in the church, in which perhaps in a previous decade or so back, that maybe many times it was said that the blessings of Abraham are being slowly removed from the United States of America. Well, it seems as though even though we do have many problems, and even though we do have trillions of dollars of debt, and even though things have been bad in many economic ways, I guess you could say, it doesn't appear as though God removed the blessings. It appears to me as though those blessings have been taken by unrighteous individuals. And I think that if you take a look at what has been exposed, even just on the surface, it didn't go on long enough, probably needs to go on more and more and more and more, the Department of Government Efficiency. It seems as though it's very likely that many of the financial blessings that have been given to the people of the United States of America haven't been removed by God. They've been removed by unjust and evil men. I believe there's the allusion to that within Paul's prophecy to young Timothy, that evil men, people who are sadistic, we see them all around us in society today, but he mentions in 2 Timothy chapter 3 that these kind of men would be narcissists, not just the run-of-the-mill individual, they would be people that are seeking wealth for themselves, they're greedy, they're ambitious, not in the right way, and they seek for themselves rather than serving the people. And I think we see a lot of examples of that and have seen enough to prove the point. The founding fathers took inspiration from the second book of the Bible, the Exodus, and what was happening to ancient Israel, and they understood that their own desire for independence from King George was very similar to what ancient Israel went through in rebelling against the Egyptian Pharaoh. In fact, it was a narrative that was repeated over and over again and believed over 250 years ago that, hey, what we're going through today in the 1770s and the 1780s and fighting against the King of England is almost identical to what ancient Israel went through in the book of Exodus. In fact, many colonial preachers, and pamphlets were big at that time. I guess Benjamin Franklin was a printer of pamphlets. But pamphleteers and preachers were very common, and they likened Britain's oppression to Egypt's bondage, casting America as a modern-day Israel and seeking freedom. That was a common notion back at the time of our founding. The Exodus narrative was a very powerful metaphor for divine deliverance from tyranny. And while the founders themselves didn't often use the term Pharaoh to compare that to the King of England, they did lean into the themes of unjust kingship, divine providence, and moral rebellion, that there could be a thing as such as rebellion that is based on moral beliefs, and that they must follow through on those things, just like the children of Israel, just like Moses and Aaron, and all those millions of people. For example, Thomas Jefferson, in the Declaration of Independence, listed grievances against King George that are very similar to the biblical complaints against Pharaoh, including obstruction of justice, refusal to let the colonies govern themselves, and the use of military force against them. John Adams and others referred to the king as a tyrant, a term often associated with Pharaoh in sermons of the time. We'll have to remember and look back that what happened in the United States of America was beyond the thinking capacity of most people or the governments of the world leading up to that time. It wasn't as though any government gave their citizens the kind of freedoms that we hold dear today. It just didn't happen. There was the divine right of kings. There were monarchies in Europe. There were tyrants in the rest of the world, and there still are today. What we have experienced in this nation today is nothing short of miraculous. It's through God's intervention. There are many revolutionary sermons that frequently invoked Exodus, with ministers declaring that just as God delivered Israel from Pharaoh, he would deliver America from British rule. If that's not finding the inspiration in the Bible for change in life, I don't know what does. The framing of these ministers and by the founding fathers helped justify what was called rebellion, not just in a political sense, but morally and spiritually, that it is our duty to reject that kind of oversight in our lives. It was about resisting a ruler who violated the divine principles of God Almighty himself, of justice and liberty. I'm going to go into the last portion of the message today, and I've already told the guys in the booth that, okay, it might be difficult to keep up with a lot of scriptures, so you may want to jot these down as I read them in case they can't get to them, and put them up if you're fond of taking notes. But there are many freedoms that are derived directly from the Bible that, as I mentioned, we understand today. We probably within the Constitution and the First Amendment, as you know, it protects the right to speak freely, including religious and political expression. I'll just read these. Maybe some of them will be quickly. Try to stay up. Proverbs 18:21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. Now, maybe one thing that was implied at the time of the writing of the Constitution and the amendments to the Constitution was that there would be a responsibility on the part of the individual to use those newfound freedoms and rights in a responsible way. Sometimes today people get confused and we understand that you can't scream there's a fire when there's no fire in a crowded theater. It's common sense. You shouldn't do that. It's not the right thing to do. It's unlawful to do. But understood was the implication that people as citizens would be responsible enough not to abuse the privileges and the freedoms that were associated with our founding. Does that make sense? Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 15, speaking the truth in love. And then there's this example in the book of Acts, chapter 4, verses 19 and 20. Peter and John refused to stop preaching. They said, "We cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard." That was revolutionary at the time of the 1770s for an entire nation to believe that way. We read it in the Bible and say, okay, they did that. They were speaking on God's behalf. But the men and the women who stood up for right and wrong, all the way from John Adams and Thomas Jefferson to all the way to Abraham Lincoln, believed that these rights were given to them and these privileges were given to them by God himself. The Bible emphasizes responsible speech. It affirms the moral imperative to speak the truth, especially in the face of injustice and persecution. And sometimes, depending on how severe it can be in this day and age, You might be taking your life in your hands to cry aloud and spare not. I think that maybe we'll find that out in many of our lifetimes before the gospel message is finished, because this is something that must be given to the house of Israel and to the rest of the world, that these things come from God. In the Fifth and the Sixth Amendments, they protect against self-incrimination, they guarantee a free trial, and they presume innocence until proven guilty. Where does that come from? Comes from the Bible. It didn't come from enlightened thinkers like John Locke. In Deuteronomy 19 and verse 15, it shows that one witness is not enough. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. That's where we get a lot of our jurisprudence from even today. In Exodus chapter 23 and verse 7, it says, "Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will justify the wicked." In John 7 and verse 51, Nicodemus said, "Does our law judge a man before it hears him and knows what he is doing?" That is something that is embodied in our legal code, that you have the right to defend yourself. Now, again, it has been often misused, and sometimes justice is whatever the best you can buy. But still, in principle, it has been codified in law. There was an interesting law that is given in the Bible called the Cities of Refuge. The Cities of Refuge were established under the law of Moses, and you'll find these, don't even try to bring them up on the screen, guys, but you'll find them in several distinct places. If you want to write these down, you'll find the Cities of Refuge were established in Numbers 35, Deuteronomy 19, and Joshua 20. There were six designated cities of refuge in the land of Israel that they were to establish, that if something happened, if, let's say, and these things do happen, somebody was accidentally killed, or there was even a murder, that individual would have a right to flee to a city of refuge. And the purpose for that, and there were six of them, there were three on the east side of the River Jordan, three on the west side of the River Jordan, because the apportionment of the land, there was a large tribe, the tribe of Reuben, and then Gad to the north, and these were all on the west side of the Jordan River. That's where, and half the tribe of Manasseh, so there was a large swath of people there. They had three cities of refuge there. And these cities of refuge were to prevent blood vengeance by an avenger, a family member who would just get upset and angry because somebody may have been accidentally killed, or somebody's ox had gored somebody and they bled out or whatever. So it prevented a family member from seeking retribution. It was to ensure that the accused received a fair trial before the entire congregation. And it helped distinguish between an intentional murder, as we know that's part of our law today, and an accidental killing. These are key principles in modern jurisprudence today. These verses show a deep concern for justice, for evidence, for fairness. It's foundational to both biblical law and American law that we have today. Now, we know that the Constitution grants freedom of religion. That's in the First Amendment. It prohibits government establishment of religion and protects the free exercise of religion. We read in Joshua chapter 24 and verse 15, Joshua said, "Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve." Now, you might say, well, what has that got to do with the freedom of religion? Well, they were told to worship God. They were encouraged to worship God, just as those individuals during the time of the early establishment of our nation. Most people went to church. Most people went to church every Sunday. A few people went to church on the Sabbath, as we know from the 1600s and the establishment of the Sabbath-keeping churches in Rhode Island. But most people went to church during those years. They heard the Bible expounded to them. In Romans 14 and verse 15, it says, "Let each be fully convinced in his own mind." Again, the freedom of religion. Read the book. Understand the law. Abide by it. Be convinced. Be convicted in your own mind in the spiritual application of the law. And then, of course, they drew their inspiration from the examples, the powerful examples of people like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who refused to compromise and to worship false gods, and they asserted their conscience over the coercion. This is what the United States did against the King of England, because they had a state religion. People came to this land for freedom of religion, to express themselves in the way that they determined based on the law of God. Not totally perfect, understand. It will be in the world tomorrow. But in the same way, these same verses are going to be used. Romans 14, let each be fully convinced in his own mind. What this nation has done has been so unique and so different through its history, so amazing. It has been copied in some ways by other nations. And whenever it's copied, and whenever the law of God is copied and utilized in any document, there are always going to be good things that happen as a result. The Bible affirms freedom of conscience and the right to worship God without compulsion. Because God's not going to force anybody to worship him, right? Freedom of choice. Free will is captured in the Constitution of the United States, our founding, and also in the Bible. No one is coerced to do anything. You have to choose what is right and wrong. The Constitution and the Fourth Amendment guards against unreasonable searches and seizures. Where did that come from? Notice Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 10 through 11. I won't read the entire verse that you see, but when you make a loan, you shall not go into his house to get his pledge. Now, if somebody lended somebody money, they couldn't just, because that person owed them something, just go in and take it. The individual was protected, you see. This law respects personal privacy and property, even if there is debt collection. I think it's towards the end of the book of, I think it's Deuteronomy. I didn't even check this. This one just comes to mind. The law of inheritance, upon which our modern law is founded today, is found right in the pages of the Bible. In fact, there was a situation in which that a man had only daughters. He didn't have any sons. And under the law, they had no protection until they took their case to Moses. And he took it to God and he said, you know, the daughters of whatever the name was, the daughters have a fair argument, and established a law based on that example. It really is amazing. The Sixth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees a speedy public trial by an impartial jury. And there are biblical parallels. In Leviticus 19 and verse 15, it says, "Do not pervert justice. Judge your neighbor fairly." And of course, the caution is found in Proverbs chapter 18. The reason sometimes you have to go slow, you have to be careful about how you administer the law and how you listen to witnesses. Proverbs 18 and verse 17 says, "The first to plead his case seems right until another comes and examines him." And how often in your own life have you had examples like this, maybe with your kids, maybe with friends, maybe with somebody who wants you to intervene, when something happens and somebody comes and informs you of something, oh yeah, that doesn't sound right, that person, they shouldn't have done that. And then you hear the other side of the story and you say, oh, wait a minute. Now that person sounds right. You have to judge. It's kind of like Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof, where they're asking for Tevye's advice. And he says, I'm not going to even go into it because I'll mess up the example since it's just coming right to the top of my mind here. I don't want to. But you can understand the point of view. The Bible shows that justice demands impartiality, transparency, and the right to be heard, which are all echoed in the American legal system. Not the case in every country. Not everywhere do you find innocent until proven guilty. In some societies, you're presumed to be guilty, and you have to prove your innocence before the court. And in some really drastic religious societies, it's always the woman that is guilty no matter what, and she's going to pay the penalty. That's unfortunate. In the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, it prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. You find that in some societies today. My ninth grade civics teacher had been in the U.S. Army, and he was stationed in Saudi Arabia. And he witnessed this happening in the marketplace, that a thief was caught, and immediately they brought out a block of wood and an axe, and they chopped off his right hand. That is cruel and unusual punishment. The Bible does not allow that kind of punishment for such a case. In Genesis chapter 9 and verse 6, we see the sanctity of life. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. It is fair. That's the first time that was invoked after the time of the flood. In Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 3, there is a limit to corporal punishment, lest your brother be degraded in his eyes. So even in punishment, the Bible calls for dignity, for restraint, and this is mirrored in the constitutional protections that we have in our society today. In Psalm 32, we read in verse 12, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people he has chosen as his own inheritance." And finally, in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 17, it says, "Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty." There's the spiritual aspect of God's law, and it's present in our lives all the time. It may not be always applied in a spiritual sense by imperfect human beings, but where the law of God is followed and where the law of God is enacted, there is a blessing. My purpose today was to show that the nation we live in and the blessings that we enjoy are not random at all. This nation isn't founded on the principles of the great thinkers of the Enlightenment age like John Locke and others. It is wholly based on the greatest book ever written. And I'm gratified, and maybe this will sound political to some, and if it does, then too bad. Get over it. I am gratified that our current president invokes God's name, and people say, he's not perfect, he does this, he's brash, he's braggadocious, he's this and that and the other thing. Get over it. I'm sorry that you feel that way. But I'm gratified that our current president invokes the name of God and gives credit for our national blessings to God. May God bless America for his purpose.